Ian, we have chatted before. Can you just kind of, in a nutshell, tell me a little bit about your story? And I know you've probably done this 100 times, but if you can just tell me in a nutshell, who are you?
Right. So, you know, my name is Ian Manuel, and I'm a unique individual, I believe, because I survived some incredible circumstances to be, you know, sitting here in front of you today and prepared to present my story to the University of Evansville tonight. I was sentenced to life when I was 13 years old for the crime of attempted murder, which occurred in Tampa, Florida. And it's a sentence that most people don't come back from. And by the grace of God, my will to survive and some pretty awesome legal strategy for my legal team, I was able to overcome some insurmountable odds to be sitting before you today.
And, you know, one of the things that we discussed whenever we talked on the phone was, you know, you were in prison for 26 years, and 18 of those you were in solitary confinement. And, you know, kind of going back to that interview, and it just occurred to me, you know, most people don't really know what that's like. Can you describe to us what were those 18 years for you?
So it was a bunch of ups and downs for me. You know, solitary confinement was an everyday Olympics because there was hurdles you had to overcome in order not to lose your sanity, to maintain your hope of some type of future. And on top of it, you know, I had a life without parole sentence. I had lost every immediate family member I had. And so it was torturous, man. You know, they used lights, 24-hour lights on all day to torture you. They use chemical agent application. And when I say chemical agents, people might think of, you know, they're using chemical agents in America? Like, it's not the type of chemical agents that, you know, Syria uses, but it's some very strong gas that they use for riots, but it's misused when you put it in the hands of people who have no regard for human life, you know, the correctional officers. I was tortured with chemical, not only chemical agent application, but also psychotropic medication injections that I didn't need. I was tied down to beds so long it felt like I had rigor mortis. I think the longest I was tied down with no movement was like 16 consecutive hours. Yeah, you have to have a very strong will, and you also have to use your imagination. Some people dive deep into their minds and it turns into schizophrenia. I dove into my imagination, and then thank God I was injected with a creative gene. And I used my creativity and my imagination to sustain me, and I started writing poetry. And my poetry was nothing more than me trying to bring to life my imagination. You know, the great artist Vincent van Gogh said, I dream my paintings and I paint my dreams. And for me, my paintbrush was my pen, and my dreams and my poems were my dreams that I created.
What kind of poetry do you write about? What were you writing about when you were there?
Great question. So, you know, initially someone sent me Tupac's book, The Rose That Grew From Concrete. And I looked at his poetry and I was like, I could do this. You know, initially I'm like, I can do this. And I started rewriting his poetry, and I shared it with the other prisoners, and the other prisoners started giving me their feedback on it. And prisoners are the toughest critics in the world. They're very hard to please. So when I was able to see that, I received a lot of good feedback from the poetry. It gave me the confidence to, you know, go out and start writing my own poetry. So I started writing poetry initially about what was around me. There was the Genie in the Bottle poem, which was about solitary confinement. There was the wasp in the window, and it's about a dead wasp that I found inside the crack of my window. And I wanted to free it, so I took a piece of a broom and tried to fish it out of there, but nothing could move it out of this enclosure that it was in. So there was nothing left but for me to pick up my pen and my try to free it with my poetry. And I wrote this poem called A Waltz in the Window, and that poem was studied by the School of Visual Arts for an entire semester. And so that little waltz that I couldn't give a proper burial and get out of that window ended up traveling all around the world through my poetry. So that's how powerful poetry can be sometimes. And there was other poems. There was poems about death. You know, I lost all of my family, and so I wrote a poem called Buying Time. And there was other poems about inspiration, a poem called Every Time I Breathe, just about the hope of blocking out everything else but having the hope that things would change. There was poems, romantic poems. You know, I was placed in solitary confinement as a 15-year-old kid, so I wanted to know if I had what it took to maintain a relationship, to bring to a relationship all the qualities that a woman needed in a man. And it's one of my biggest crowd pleasers when I perform that poem, Am I Romantic Enough? And the response from the female audience members let me know that I do have what it takes and that I am romantic enough.
Another thing that you mentioned was whenever, you know, you got this sentence and you're standing in front of the judge, you mentioned, you know, I turn around and I hug my mom for the last time. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Why was it the last time, and how was that relationship with her after you left that courtroom?
So the relationship with my mom after that, It was up and down because there were some things that happened, you know, surrounding my sentencing. Like I would have never pled guilty if she hadn't told me to, and so there were some things that came up that had her telling me when I wrote and asked the mom why I would have never received this life sentence if you had never told me to, and then she, you know, the feedback she would give would be, she wrote me when I was 14 and said, Ian, don't try to lay that guilt trip on me. If you hadn't been out there committing these crimes, you wouldn't have been in this position in the first place. And, you know, it was just up and down between me and her. We always had a tumultuous relationship. But I loved my mom, and I still love her dearly. But the reason she never visited me, you know, so I found out later, was she said that it would tear her apart to come visit me, and knowing that I would never be released, that she couldn't take me with her, that there would never come a time that I would walk out the gates into her arms. So I kind of understood that. I don't have a child. I love children. Children love me. So I try to understand from a mother's standpoint, but from the child standpoint, growing up in solitary confinement alone, it was very difficult to know that the last time I touched my mother was in the day that I was sentenced to life in prison. And so someday I'll return to Tampa, and that's one of the first things I'll do is visit her grave.
What is one thing that you would tell children, and you know, you say you love children, what is one thing that maybe you would tell 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds who are out there maybe with the wrong company or making some decisions that are not good for their future? What would you tell them?
Yeah, so to learn from my mistakes, that not only to learn from my mistakes, but when you're taking an action, to play the tape all the way through, especially young kids that are in the sports and have to study film. That's a metaphor, analogy that I use, playing the tape all the way through, and try to show them how the same way that if you pass that ball, or if you didn't pass that ball, you know, you missed that goal, you missed that, your teammate missed that point. In the same way that if you steal that car, if you hit this person that isn't bothering you, if you take this property, if you shoot this gun, if you don't play that tape all the way through, you're only caught up in that moment and not seeing that the years of pain that you're not only causing yourself, you're going to cause your family, the years that you rob yourself of, because you're not thinking all the way through. I mean, if I could have seen ahead all the pain that I was gonna have to suffer from 13 to 39 until I released, there was no way I would have pulled that trigger, you know. But I was living for the momentum. It's this thing I call the momentum of the moment. And we all get caught up in the momentum of the moment, and it carries us like a wave. I speak about it in this poem I got. But so that's one thing I tell kids, to play the tape all the way through. But there's also something else I tell kids. I tell kids sometimes, you know, when they're in hopeless situations, I tell them, I came up with a mantra, and it's called the impossible is possible. It's a mantra that has carried me for so long. Because you can look at it, you could be in a helpless situation now, but I want you to look at my situation, man. Listen, I had a natural life sentence with life probation. I had no outside help. I was abandoned and left for dead and told I was nothing. I felt like I was worth something. I felt like I was a diamond in the dirt, like my Instagram title is. You know what I'm saying? But people wouldn't see me, and I teach them to believe in themselves even when no one else does. That is something that has sustained me all these years.
I guess what is one thing that, you know, after coming out, you kind of have seen in the society that, you know, you wish it was different, or something that you want to help, you know, the people understand maybe we can do better in this area?
There's so many ways that we can alter the current criminal justice system. You know, number one, people always say vote, but it goes deeper than just voting. Voting is a key part, but also how about contacting the people that are already in office, applying pressure there to, you know, change certain policies that are already in place for people that are in prison, that are being treated lesser than human.
Another thing that I was wondering is, you know, you've had all these interviews and you've spoken at various locations and states. What is one question that maybe you don't get asked a lot or at all that you actually want to talk about?
That's a good question, because I get asked all type of questions. Just about how long, maybe, you know, my pain, man. I got a lot of pain. You know, people see me and they think everything's all right because I'm so articulate, because I'm so, I come off as so intelligent. But there's a lot of pain, man. You know, Ian, what drives you? I think what drives you is a question that I never get, because people think I got it all together, and I do. I have a plan of where I want to be. And the things that drives me is the people that abandoned me, the people that the prison officials that treated me like I was less than, and the people on the outside since I've been out that looked at me and just thought, he's nothing, he's nobody, you know. And the people that I told that I was driven, I got one tattoo when I was in prison. After I got out of solitary confinement, I just posted on Instagram about this. That's why it's so fresh. And I was on the floor in pain getting this tattoo, and the guy walked by and he read the tattoo, which says living legend on my chest. And this other white guy is on top of me running his tattoo gun, and the guy walks by, Jeffro, he says, living legend, yeah, right, in your own mind. And I thought about that recently, because that was the only tattoo I've ever got, the only tattoo I plan on getting. It's something I dreamed about in solitary. I knew what I had already endured was legendary. I knew that if I survived and got out of prison, it would be even more legendary. But not only that, I knew I had the talent to make it big. And so that's what I don't get asked about. Ian, what drove you? What drove you, and what still drives you? Well, what drives me, man, is to prove everybody wrong, man, that I was really worth something, that I was more than just a piece of trash to be cast away forever in society, man, that I had value, man, and that I was worth saving, not throwing away.
For my last question, I wanted to know, you know, when we chatted on the phone, you talked about that moment whenever the judge read, you know, your life sentence. But what was that moment like when you know, the you told me about the guard coming to the door and saying, "Hey, pack your stuff. You're going to leave." Can you just tell me a little bit about that dynamic? And do you have time to say goodbye to the people, maybe if you have friends inside?
Well, I'll answer that question two ways. First of all, I was in Hillsborough County Jail. I had only been back a week. So I did know one or two people that I had knew from, you know, when I was in the detention center, actually, way back. They just happened to be in the same quad in confinement with me. But it was nighttime, excuse me. So I think they were already asleep. You know, that's how people deal with solitary. They try to sleep a lot. But I really, what went through my mind was I thought about a lot of things. I thought about the professor at Florida State Prison who actually has the same name as you, who wrote me and asked to take, you know, he was interested in taking my case. And he didn't. And then later, after I sent him all my paperwork, he later took another kid's case named Kenneth Young, who's still in prison. But he wrote, I thought about how the lawyer that did take my case, that did think I was interested, Brian Stevenson, how he had worked diligently to get me out, how I had overcome losing everything, how this was finally about to happen despite everything I had endured, man. Near-death experiences. It felt like an out-of-the-body experience, man, when that man opened the door. Mind you, he cuffed me up, by the way. Like, I had to turn around and get cuffed up to be released and go, because I was being placed in a transport van to go to the other jail in Tampa. But it felt surreal because you're traumatized by your experiences and you're wondering if, are they going to say, no, wait, hold up. No, the paperwork wasn't signed, or no, he owes us some more time, and it was a scary but good feeling, man. But I tell you this: once I finally walked out of that door, it was everything I had ever dreamed, man, and more. The feeling of freedom is like that breath of fresh air after you've been underwater holding your breath for so long. And I've had a near a drowning experience. So it's like you're given a second chance at life from being surrounded by water, holding your breath, and then finally you're rescued by the lifeguard and you're able to breathe again. And that's why I like to end this interview with this poem. Every time I breathe, I feel the need to justify my existence, to take this moment that I'm living and enjoy every millisecond in it. My life and my struggles, not many can comprehend it. My desire for freedom burns like a sausage inside a skillet. Tomorrow isn't promised, so I'm thankful for this minute. Though in prison, merely existing, it's like my life has been suspended. But that means it's temporary because I haven't been expelled. And I still got a chance as long as I can in and exhale every time I breathe. Every time I breathe, I'm thankful for the oxygen from the trees and little things like little bees that get overlooked until they sting. Every day I'm faced with obstacles that block the progress to my dreams. But the blockades only masquerades like costumes on Halloween. I've been through enough pain to make a sane man just green. But instead, I take a deep breath and just breathe. Every time I breathe, the cosmos come out of my nostrils like particles of Prada coming out of your console. My soul is like a chihuahua you didn't include in your carpool. My lungs relax and collapse like a bottom sitting on a bar stool. Every time I breathe, every time I breathe, I become an intergalactic being, stepping out of character like a chiropractor, snapping peas. I prayed so many times, it's like I got arthritis in my knees, but I still get down and bow my head because I continue to believe that as long as I can breathe, God's going to make a change, and my circumstances only chance is for me to glorify his name. You don't know me, homie, but there's odds I've already overcame. So if praying works, but hurts, then I can stand a little pain. I want to end this part by thanking God for bringing me to these heights. And I make a promise to always honor and cherish this breath of life. Every time I breathe, every time I breathe, every time I breathe.